So this evening, we begin the first of our two sessions leading up to Chag HaPesach. I must say, just as a preliminary comment, I had in mind to bring something from the Torah of Reb Chaim Kanievsky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. They released a Haggadah of his sayings and teachings. I haven't finished it. I'm only about 200 pages in, still a good 300 pages to go. But something that caught my eye, not particularly pilpilistic, but struck a chord. And that is, it is known that Reb Chaim would spend many hours, actually, in his searching for chometz. It was a real piece-by-piece operation. It could take well into the night. And it's told that on one occasion, one of his grandchildren joined him, wanted to search for the chametz with him, and Reb Chaim would take everything out. He took out a drawer and emptied out all its contents, checked absolutely everything. And then his grandson says to him, "What can I do?" And Reb Chaim says, "Put everything back in the drawer, neatly as it was." So the grandson was a little bit disappointed. After all, that's cleaning up. That's not bedikas chametz. And Reb Chaim saw that he felt a little bit hard done by. He said, "You know, your grandmother likes things to be neat and orderly. The mitzvah of bedikas chametz, since we can do bittel, so bedika is midrabanan. Making sure that your grandmother doesn't get upset is minatera. And therefore, that's a perfectly good mitzvah for you to be involved in." So a bit of perspective, I think, and never goes astray. Either way, if we begin our discussion by referring to a matter of minhag that accompanies, I would almost say ushers in Pesach, and that is Tanis B'chorus, the fast of the firstborn. Of course, for those who are not firstborns, this is not a practical thing for them. But I think there's something to learn for everyone from Tanis B'chorim. Some people like myself, I'm not a natural born firstborn, but I took over, I was a B'chor by proxy for 13 years for my eldest son until I retired again back to the private sector. But what is the source of this idea? Where does it come from? The Gemara doesn't speak about it. Tanis B'chorim, the firstborns, fast on Erev Pesach. The most explicit source is in a work called Maseches Sofrim. Maseches Sofrim, which is redacted just a little bit after the Gemara, in the time of early Gaonim. And in chapter 21 of Maseches Sofrim, it states, "Habechorim mis'anim be'erev Pesach." The firstborns, they fast on Erev Pesach. This is the source that is quoted by the Torah and others. It should be noted, in the interests of full disclosure in terms of sources, it seems very likely, as pointed out by the Rosh and others, that there is an earlier source for Tanis B'chorim. And that is the Yerushalmi, and of course Yerushalmi is early, from Chazal themselves. The Yerushalmi in Maseches Psachim notes that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi used to fast every Erev Pesach. That was his practice. However, the Yerushalmi states that it's not certain as to why he did this. It could be for one of two reasons. Either, says the Yerushalmi, because Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was a Bechor, which I personally did not know before this, but Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was a Bechor. Maybe it was for that reason. Or maybe, says the Yerushalmi, because he was an Istinus. And the definition of an Istinus, if you've heard the term, is someone who's very fastidious, shall we say. Some people, if they eat in the day, they can't eat at night. And therefore, in order to ensure that he would fulfill the mitzvahs of Leil HaSeder properly and eat his matzah and maror exactly as he should, that's why he abstained from eating on Erev Pesach. Two very different possibilities, and the Gemara remains uncertain about this. But we see from the very fact that the Gemara considered that the reason perhaps that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was fasting on Erev Pesach is because he was a Bechor, that itself seems to be evidence, says the Rosh, that the Yerushalmi also endorses the concept of Tanis Bechorim. But what is the fast all about? Why do Bechorim, why do the firstborn fast on Erev Pesach? Masechet Sofrim doesn't say. But the answer that is given by the classic sources, the Torah and others, is that it is Zecher Lenes, remembrance of the miracle. After all, the Bechorim were in quite some danger, in a precarious situation, Makas Bechoros, and they were miraculously spared from the plague. And that leads to the annual practice of Tanis Bechorim as a Zecher for that miracle. According to this explanation, we should note that we do not mark the miracle at exactly the time that it happened. The time that the miracle happened was midnight on Seder night. Of course, you can't be fasting then because there's so many things you need to eat and drink from the Torah and from the Rabbanan. And therefore, we pull back the fast to the earlier time frame, but it really is about the events of midnight on Seder night. It's not about Erev Pesach. That necessarily one must say. The Be'er Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Salant, one of the wonderful Chachmei Yerushalayim from the late 20th century, he asks a number of questions. He's quite troubled by this explanation, and some of his questions are quite straightforward. Firstly, says the Be'er Yosef, will someone please explain to me, since when do we mark and celebrate a miracle by fasting? As if to say, think of all the other miracles that we know. We do not mark them by with a fast. Here are the Bechorim. And if anything, if we're looking to commemorate the fact that they were saved, so let them have a special Seudas Hodah. I mean, that seems to be more par for the course. It's unusual, seemingly possibly counterintuitive, even, that we were saved, and let's have a fast to celebrate. It's not the standard way to celebrate. One should mention, it is a parenthetical note, but there are two of the Hasidic masters who actually said the same thing. Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch of Zidichov and the Kamarna Rebbe. They both suggested the same thing. Maybe one heard it from the other. It's quite a radical suggestion. And that is, says Rav Tzvi Hirsch of Zidichov, I think he was first, he says, or suggests, or more than suggests, he insists that the correct reading of Maseches Sofrim is not HaBechorim Mis'anim Be'erev Pesach, the Bechorim fast on Erev Pesach, but rather the reading should be HaBechorim Mis'angim Be'erev Pesach. They enjoy themselves on Erev Pesach, from the word oneg, which means they have some type of, well, not a farbrengen, but some type of a get-together, and the complete opposite of a fast. Through the course of the ages, Mis'angim, the Gimel, got lost, and Mis'angim became Mis'anin, and a celebratory feast became a fast. That is the suggestion of Reb Tzvi Hirsch of Zidichov. It's quite a daring suggestion. It has been demonstrated that it's probably impossible that this is true. In other words, from the context of the way that Maseches Sofrim talks, there is no doubt that when it says Mis'anim, it means Mis'anim. The context is fasting. There is no question that it means Mis'anim contextually. However, I think we'll all appreciate, and we know from experience, matters such as context and the like are a little match for a Hasidic vort, and therefore the two somehow live side by side. But either way, assuming that the way the day is marked is with a Tanis, why celebrate a miracle through a Tanis? Secondly, the minhag is, the widespread minhag, is that only males, male firstborn, fast. Not female firstborn. If the firstborn is a son, fast and Erev Pesach, as he knows. If the firstborn is a daughter, gets a pass. There's no Tanis Bechorim. One should know, by the way, that actually is not unanimously agreed upon. There are opinions, after all, The eldest was smitten by the Makas Bechoros, which means the miracle accrued both to the elder, the firstborn boys, as much as to the firstborn girls equally, which means in principle there should be no difference between them, and they should both be marking the miracle through fasting. And indeed there is an opinion among the Rishonim who says that firstborn girls should also fast, and it's cited in the Shulchan Aruch. The Ramah, raising the flag for Ashkenazim, says that the minhag is that the girls don't fast, and I think that's the universal minhag, which means that in this matter, Sfardim graciously deferred to Ashkenazi custom, and the women don't fast. But the question is, why not? After all, as we said, if it's to mark the miracle applied, they were both equal beneficiaries, both the males and the females. Why is Tanis Bechorim only for the males? And the final question, which he asks, is, and it's a bit of a thoroughness question, but important to ponder. Who nowadays are the beneficiaries of that miracle? Not the firstborn. The beneficiaries of the miracle nowadays are all the descendants of those firstborns. In other words, if we go back to generation one, where it actually happened, the ones who were miraculously spared were the firstborn. All of their descendants should mark the day, whether firstborn or not. Conversely, if you're not descended from one of those firstborns, you're not part of the miracle. The fact that you personally are firstborn is neither here nor there. So the distribution of the fast, or the whatever it is, to the firstborn in every generation doesn't seem to be marking the miracle that it happened to the firstborn in those generation, in that first generation. And that is why, after these very interesting, I would say compelling questions, the Be'er Yosef suggests that perhaps, and he phrases his words very carefully because he's really suggesting something contrary or alongside the Torah. And therefore he says, in classic rabbinic tradition, were it not for the words of the Torah, I would have said the following. And that is, the event of Makas Bechoros, the plague of the firstborn, was momentous for the Jewish firstborn. How so? Because in being spared from the plague, they then became consecrated to Hashem. As the Pasuk says on a number of occasions throughout the Chumash, Ki li kol bechor, because all bechorim belong to me. On the day that I smote the firstborn, Hikdashti osamli, they are sanctified to me. And what is the practical upshot of that event, of that consecration? It's that the avodah, from that point onwards, formally lay within the domain of the firstborn. Up until Matan Torah, and even following Matan Torah, it was the firstborn who did the avodah. And that, as far as we know, is how things would have continued. They're consecrated to Hashem. They represent, each firstborn represents their family in doing the avodah. As we know, tragically, that was all lost. At the time of the Chet HaEgel, where the firstborns were also involved, and according to the Medrash Bamidbar Rabbah, perhaps they were primarily involved. If it's the firstborn who did the Avodah, it's likely that they were the ones who most represented the people in the Avodah of the Golden Calf. And as a result of that, as we know, they forfeited the Avodah. It was taken away from them and given to the Kohanim. And that remains a low point, a very tragic episode in Bechorah consciousness. And thus the situation remains. And it's true the whole year round. However, it's never more true than on Erev Pesach. Erev Pesach, when all the Jewish people converge upon the Beis HaMikdash, each family brings its korban. And what is the korban about? The korban, it's called the Pesach. It's about Hashem passing over the houses of the Jewish people, which consecrated the firstborn. It's a very bittersweet time for the Bechorim, who aren't Kohanim. Because this is a time that's officially celebrating their elevated status, but they lost it. And it's very keenly felt on Erev Pesach. And therefore, says Ber Yosef, the Erev Pesach was, to a certain degree, a day of mourning for the firstborn. It's a day to ponder and contemplate what they had and what they lost. And that's what Tanis B'Churim is about. And according to this understanding, the timing of the fast is exactly what it needs to be. No earlier, no later. The difficult time for the firstborn was Erev Pesach, when the Korban Pesach was being brought. That's when the fast is. And moreover, we can understand why it is the firstborn of each generation who fasts. Because in each generation, they would have been the ones to do the avoda, were it not for the avoda being lost at the time of the Egel. And this also explains why it is only the males who fast and not the females, because if it is fundamentally over the loss of the avodah, that's something within the domain of the male, Bechorim, they are the ones who had it and lost it. And this, therefore, is the Be'er Yosef's stunning, I would say, explanation of what's behind Tanis Bechorim. It is a completely different way of looking at what's behind the fast. And of course, we understand that the day is marked with a fast, not with a celebratory feast. No Bechor at the time of the Beis HaMikdash bringing a Korban Pesach felt that there was something to celebrate about that, only something to reflect the loss over. And these are the words of Be'er Yosef. And there the matter lay, until Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach, also one of the Chachmei Yerushalayim, and the two, of course, knew each other very well, from what I recall from my father, Zatzal, it was Reb Shlomo Zalman who prevailed upon Reb Yosef Salant to write his Sefer Be'er Yosef. He was giving droshas and they were fabulous, but he wasn't writing them down or publishing them. And Reb Shlomo Zalman is the one who told him to write them down. And Reb Shlomo Zalman has what you could call a Yerushalmi PS to this explanation. And that is, typically, customarily, the firstborn do not fast the whole day. What they do is they find a siyum, they make a siyum, or they find a siyum, and with that they end the fast. And it's practically universal custom. It's not mentioned in the early sources, but it's become the minhag. And the question is, how is that an appropriate way to end the fast? And moreover, we're not aware that any other fast can be ended in this way. As if to say, a fast is a fast is a fast. I mean, if you're in, you're in. And here, the Bechorim, across the board, they find a siyum, and that's how they end the fast. And Shlomo Zalman said, because in the siyum, in what's represented by the siyum, is the nechama for the Kohen, for the Bechorim. In other words, the Bechor, he stands there on Erev Pesach, he has to give up his korban to the Kohanim, because he can't do it anymore. And he kind of has a feeling, he knows what he had, he knows what he's lost, and he's lost everything. And along comes a siyum and says, no, you didn't lose everything. So what are you? You're not doing the avod anymore? So welcome to the rest of the Jewish people, and you have Torah. And the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, Gedola Torah, Yosef Min HaKahuna. Torah is greater than Kahuna. Obviously, Kahuna is there for a reason, and there are certain things that only a Kohen can do. But there's nothing that will more effectively take the Bechor out of his mourning over the loss of the Avodah than to go to a Siyum and partake in something that he is an equal part in. And that is why traditionally the fast is ended with a Siyum. That's how the Kohanim console themselves. I must say, I was very taken by this explanation of the Be'er Yosef and of Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach. And it occurred to me, and perhaps it's just a feeling, but nonetheless, this approach to the fast of the firstborn, no one else really says it, but it comes out of Yerushalayim. And what does that mean? I once came across a comment of Rav Kook. The Gemara says there's a famous idea, Avira de'ara d'Yisrael machkim. The air of the land of Israel makes people wise. So Gemara, I believe in Bava Basra and Kuf Nun Ches, Avira de'ara d'Yisrael machkim. The air of the land of Israel makes people wise. And Rav Kook discusses why that is. one may have thought, no discussion necessary. It's a mystical thing. It's a cosmic thing. It's the holiness of the land of Israel. It works how it works, and hard really to engage in explaining it. And certainly one would have expected Rav Kook to say something like that, to the extent that one can have expectations of Rav Kook. And lo and behold, he says something entirely different. Rav Kook says, the reason why the air of the land of Israel makes you wise is because the land of Israel is full of all the things that the Torah speaks about. You bump into them the whole time. There's what's happening in Yerushalayim, and there's Hebron, and there's Beersheba, and there's all the places that outside of Israel you'd only read about. But when you're in Israel, you see them, you meet them, and they trigger thoughts, and they generate insights, and they get you thinking, and they support a certain consciousness, which puts you in mind of things that otherwise you might not be thinking. Very interesting explanation of Rav Kook. When you're in Eretz Yisrael, you're encountering constantly the things that the Torah is speaking about. It puts you in mind of certain things. Why do I mention this? Erev Pesach for us, for everyone, it's a busy day. And in the afternoon, there is a certain time that some people devote to reciting the order of bringing the Korban Pesach. It's in the Haggadah, in the beginning. Seder HaKrovos Korban Pesach. I think it's fair to say that if we're able to devote time for that, you've done a good job, you've been a good Jew in that respect, and you've done a good thing. But those who recall from what they call Yerushalayim Shel Pam, Yerushalayim of old, or Yerushalayim Shel Mala, the Anshei Yerushalayim, and this was told by one of the sons of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Erev Pesach, some say Bechorim, some say Bechorim is good. Erev Pesach was a time, and if you've never heard it, you wouldn't imagine it. But once you hear it, you can understand it. The atmosphere on Erev Pesach at the Kotel was like the atmosphere on Tisha B'Av. It was a day where, alongside Tisha B'Av, there was such a keen sense of the loss of the Beis HaMikdash. Tisha B'Av needs no explanation. But those who were able to make their way to the Kotel and recite the order of bringing the Korban Pesach there, they were literally face to face with where the Korban would be brought. Were they able to bring it? And there was really like an atmosphere of mourning, and there was crying, and it was a completely different experience. It's quite amazing. And it occurred to me, perhaps, that as per Rav Kook, maybe it's for this reason that this approach to Tanis Bechorim or Bechoros was really arrived at by Chachmei Yerushalayim. In other words, because they had a yearly encounter with the place of the Korban Pesach, and on a yearly basis, they themselves came face to face with what they didn't have, with what they could have and currently did not have. Perhaps that put them in mind to think, well, if this is how we feel, imagine how the Bechorim would have felt when they brought their animals, and this set them towards this understanding of Tanis Bechorim. Either way, that's a feeling for consideration. But in any case, this, I think, gives us a new, for me, a very new perspective on Tanis Bechorim. It's a retrospective because I'm a non-practicing Bechor proxy at this stage, but certainly food for thought, as they say. And with this in mind, we come to the Seder itself. And I have to say, I came across a comment in the Haggadah of Reb Leib Mintzberg, who we've been quoting from quite a bit in recent weeks. His works are called Ben Melech. And his approach to things and his perspective on things, he has this, I think, what you could call a natural vision, if that means anything. And perhaps let's get to what he says, and then you'll see what I mean. As we know, the Seder night has many component parts to it. There's certain things that we eat. There's certain things that we drink. And each thing has its explanation. As we know, it's a key part of the of the evening. Pesach is that, when we had Pesach. Al Shumma, what's Pesach all about? We give the explanation. Shem passed over the houses, that's that. Matzazu, Al Shumma, what's the matzah all about? We explain it. Marozeh, what's that all about? And so on and so forth. Charoses, right? We dip in, why charoses? Well, it's like the cement, which is a zecher for the slavery that they had, and so on and so forth. And the arba, four cups of wine, votsesi, vitzalti, everything that we eat and drink on this evening, every significant thing, shall we say, has an explanation. Says Rav Mintzberg, that's true. However, it's important to realize that all of those explanations, they are explaining those items as separate items, meaning as self-contained units. But if you put them all together, we'll readily appreciate that together they form a composite which is called a festive meal. In other words, if we would picture, and perhaps we've been conditioned, but if we would picture what is the festive meal, it's with meat and bread and a side dish, one could say, and with dips and with wine. I mean, that is a celebratory meal. That has all the trappings and all the trimmings. And at the end of the day, in the most general of senses, that's what Seder night is. It, at heart, Seder night is a meal of celebration of being released from Mitzrayim and entering into the domain of Hashem as His people. And to that end, we have the celebratory meal, which has all these pieces to it, all these parts to it. What then happens is, when you look at each part for what it is, and why it is exactly that way, you then will discover specific reasons, local explanations. Why specifically this? As if to say, if a festive meal has meat, but why is the meat specifically like this, brought as a korban and roasted specifically with all of those halachas? If a festive meal typically has bread, but why is the bread matzah and not chametz? And if it typically has a vegetable on the side, but why is that vegetable maror? And if one would normally dip into things, and that's dips are a good part, but why specifically into charoses? And why specifically four cups of wine? In other words, if we isolate each part of what makes up the Seder, it will require explanation as to why it is specifically the way it is. But don't forget, says Reb Leib Mintzberg, to put it all back together again at the end. And then you have the overarching theme that it is a festive meal because it's a celebratory evening. Very interesting perspective. It's almost like if one views all the pieces together as a symphony of sorts. But each one, when you look at it by itself, it's got its own internal melody. And you have this duality to the pieces of the Seder, each thing for itself, and then all together. And what's very interesting is, just as a concluding sentiment in this regard, the maror, and it's an important question. We remember the bitter times. We do. Maror is there, whatever you have for maror. And whether it's bitter or not, and that's a whole discussion, but it has elements of bitterness, and we say explicitly, we eat maror in order to remember the bitter times. But why do you want to remember the bitter times? Not for its own sake, but rather in order to appreciate the better times that came. If you're mindful of the bitter, you appreciate the better. That's how appreciation works. It turns out, therefore, that the maror actually, it has an enhancing effect on the story. Because without it, you wouldn't really, it almost like brings out the flavor of Yetzias Mitzrayim. It gives it an added element. But isn't that the relationship of the vegetable that you have together with meat? If you have meat and then you have something like a little bit bitter together with it, you wouldn't have that bitter thing by itself, but why do you have it together with the meat? In order to bring out a certain aspect of the flavor. I'm no expert, but that is a basic concept. And what's fascinating, therefore, is that the way that the concept of Maror relates to the concept of Korban Pesach, that is to say, bitter times to redemption times, and it brings out a further element as concept, is exactly parallels the relationship that they have on a culinary level, where the bitterness of the vegetable brings out the taste of the meat, and thus you have this multi-layered relationship between all of these parts of the Seder. So I found that to be a very thought-provoking idea, each thing for itself, and then what to make of them when they all come together. Well, with this in mind, we are ready to begin the Seder. And the Seder begins in after Kadesh and Urchatz. And as we've mentioned in the past, and once again, I saw this in the Haggadah of Reb Chaim Kanievsky, others say it as well. If you know the poem, and this is not the only poem that details the stages of the Seder night, but this one had mazel, and I think it's universally said. It's interesting that of all the 15 or 16 steps, it's only the first and second that are connected with a vav. Kadesh, Urchatz, with a vav. Kadesh and washing. From that point onwards, there's no vavs. It's not this and this and this and this. It's just this, 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 this. Yachatz, Magid, Rachza, Motzi, Matzu. That's very interesting. I don't think it was needed for the pentameter. What's the vav doing there? So Reb Chaim says, you know, there's an interesting issue that comes out on Seder night when you made Kiddush. We normally have a concept of Kiddush b'makom suda. The Kiddush needs to be followed by the meal. Now, anyone who's been to a Seder knows that the meal is going to be a long time in coming. I mean, I would not hold out too much for that. A lot happens. And the question is, where does the concept of Kiddush b'makom suda go? It must be that one fulfills at the very least the beginnings of the first step towards the suda, towards eating something, is the karpas. And it's through the karpas, actually, that we fulfill the concept of joining the kiddush with the suda. Karpas is no meal. One has less than a kazayas. But one begins to eat something. And therefore, in order to show the cohesion between the kiddush and the beginning of the meal represented by karpas, we go straight from kadesh to urchatz. We don't hang around. And that's the vav. Kadesh and urchatz straight away so that you can have your karpas. Either way. What is karpas all about? It's a bit of a mystery. There's numerous explanations. But one could perhaps develop the question by asking a different question. What does the word karpas mean? Most attempts to translate karpas, I think, will fail. The intuitive attempts are celery or parsley or vegetable or so on and so forth. I mean, none of them are actually what the word karpas means. It happens to be that karpas is a word. It's just not a word that would appear to be of much help to us. But it is found in Tanakh, and we have actually all heard it recently. And that is in Megillas Esther, in the beginning of the Megillah, when Ahasuerus has his feast. So we have a detailed description of the decor of what happened in that party. And one of the things it says is Chur Karpas Utreles. So that's the word Karpas. But what does it mean? It is a reference to the tapestries that were adorning or decorating where the mishta was. Because karpas represents a type of wool, and there it have it. So should we say that we've never seen the word karpas before the Seder night? Actually, we have. It's in Megillas Esther. So that's the good news. The bad news is that doesn't seem to be of any help to us at all, because there's many different customs with regards to what people use for karpas, but I think wool is probably not included in anyone's traditions. To the extent that, as much as we found out what karpas means, the translation of that word, pardon me, is immaterial for our discussion. However, it could be that there is another way to look at things. And this is an explanation. I heard it many years ago from my father, Zatzal. If you've never heard it, it's quite a chiddush. If you have heard it, it's unforgettable. And we start by referring back to the idea that the way to tell the story, you have to start with at the beginning. If you don't start at the beginning, you don't appreciate the end. And if you don't appreciate the end, you've missed the point of Seder night. A depiction or a characterization of Seder night, I think it does not do justice to it to call it what is popularly called a night of Jewish education. It is that, but I think it's a disservice to call it that. It is an underrepresentation, and underrepresentations are sometimes misrepresentations. In other words, it is a night of Jewish education. Okay, but the open secret is every night is a night of Jewish education. Right? Woe to the family who restricts their Jewish education to a once a year event. It is education, but it's more than that. It's a night of appreciation. That's the point. And interestingly, as Rav Dessler points out, the concept of telling the story to children is as much for the adults as it is for the children, because it stops the story from getting too cerebral or too abstract or too scholarly or in that academic sense. You have to tell it to a child, and that ensures that the level of discussion and of communication remains on a very basic level, because that's where appreciation takes place, on that very primal level. So that's very interesting. Vihigadat levincha is as much for the one telling it to the child as it is for the child itself. That's aside from the fact that I'm not sure when these times ever occurred, but I've never met a child who didn't know the story of Pesach before Seder night. I've had my children sometimes correct me on certain parts of the story. I meant to be doing the retelling, but I have to be very careful not to take any wrong steps. Otherwise, I'll have to answer to my children. Either way, it's for this reason that the story begins at the beginning. In the words of the Mishnah, Maschilim Bignus, Umesaimim B'Shevach. We begin with the negative, with the difficult parts, and we end with the positive. If you're not conscious of how negative things were, you don't appreciate how positive things then became. So we have to tell the story from the beginning. And what is the beginning? Well, it's a machlokus, but let's assume Avodim Hayinu. Chapter one of the Pesach story, we were slaves in Egypt. But as we know, with many works, chapter one is often very well preceded by a prologue. In other words, chapter one is what happened first. But the prologue is how did it get there? How did all of this come to be in the first place? And for that, we go much earlier than our time in Mitzrayim, because how did we end up in Mitzrayim in the first place? It's the events which surrounded the tensions between Yosef and the brothers, and they sold him down, and then he rose to prominence, and then there's a famine, and they came down, and before you look around, that's where we are. So chapter one is Avodah Mayinu, but the prologue is the whole thing with Yosef and the brothers. And therefore, before we begin to tell the story of Avodah Mayinu, we have to check in with the prehistory. The tensions between Yosef and the brothers can be located, or localized more correctly, into one entity, the Kesonis Pasim, the special coat that Yaakov made for Yosef. And indeed, the Gemara itself identifies it as a course of contention, so much so the Gemara famously says, and quite surprisingly, but it is the Gemara, it is Chazal, that a person shouldn't favor one child over the other child, because look what happened. Yaakov gave this coat to Yosef, and things snowballed down to Egypt. Not like they wouldn't have happened anyway, but maybe they wouldn't have happened in that way, or there, or in, so, etc. and so forth. It's the Kesonis Pasim that's really the the physical entity that embodies the contention between Yosef and the brothers. Well, what does that have to do with us? The word kasonis pasim, what does it mean? Kasonis is a tunic or a shirt or a cloak or a coat. That's kasonis. We're familiar with the word kasonis. But what about the word pasim? Some people say pasim refers to the stripe, the design of the coat, stripes. Some say multicolored, and so on and so forth. But if you look in Rashi, in Parshas Vayeshev, commenting on the words kasonis pasim, Rashi explains that it is not about the design of the coat, but it's about the material that the coat was made of. Says Rashi, you know what kasonis pasim means? Loshon kalei milas. It's an expression of fine quality wool. Kamo karpas utreles. Rashi there, in elaboration of the word kasonis pasim, takes us to that pasuk in Megillas Esther, which talks about karpas utreles, because that type of wool of karpas is the type of wool of kasonis pasim. And therefore, one of the great commentaries on the commentators on the Rambam, Rabbeinu Manoach was his name, one of the late Rishonim, explains this is what is behind karpas. Before we tell the story, before we start manishtana, etc. and so forth, we take a vegetable, and it's a vegetable for moral reasons, for the bracha of Hadamah, but we take something, and we call it karpas. And the reason why we call it karpas is because it is a remembrance for the kasonis pasim of Yosef. And we dip it into salt water as a zecher for the dipping of his coat into blood. And that's what initiated and precipitated all of the events that culminated in us being in Mitzrayim. And that's why this karpas forms the prologue to the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's quite a fascinating approach to the concept of karpas, what you could call dipping into history, but just to get a sense of what the karpas is doing as the beginning of the story. This leaves us, I think, for this evening, just to have time to take a look at Halach Ma'anya. There's a lot to talk about Halach Ma'anya. Of course, one shouldn't only speak about Halach Ma'anya. It is introductory in nature. One should also keep going. But nonetheless, we start at the beginning this evening. And what do we say? Halach Ma'anya, this is the bread of affliction, our forefathers ate in Mitzrayim. How do we know that? Apparently we know. Whoever is hungry, let them eat. Kol dichven yeseh v'yivsach. This year here, next year in Israel, this year slaves, next year free men. That is the paragraph of Halach Ma'anya. And there are a couple of important questions that any discussion of Halach Ma'anya needs to take. Firstly, it's in Aramaic. One cannot help but notice it's in Aramaic. This is before the four cups of wine. It really is in Aramaic. And the question is, why? I mean to say, what is served by having this in Aramaic? Now, it is the classic answer to this question, or the traditional answer to this question, is that in the times when this was instituted, the average person actually spoke Aramaic better than they spoke Hebrew, which for us is hard to imagine. But it is indeed so. That's why they instituted reading Unculus during the laning. People would sit and nod through the Torah reading. They wouldn't understand. And they say Unculus, and then all of a sudden they light up, because that's in Aramaic. And therefore, it's important for everyone to know, understand what's happening in the Seder, and that's why it's in Aramaic. By the way, it is important for everyone to understand what's happening in the Seder. More important for them to understand than to hear it in Hebrew and not understand. That is true. In fact, the Ramah in Hilchos Pesach, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, he actually mentions one of the Rishonim of England, Rabbeinu Yehuda of London, who would say the Haggadah in English to his family. So it is certainly important for everyone to understand. However, even if that's so, and it is so, the question still remains, but nowadays, Kahayom, that we do no longer speak Aramaic, it's not the lingua franca of the Jewish people. So why do we petrify Halach Ma'anya in Aramaic? Why do we freeze it there? If the whole point is it was moved to that language so that people understand, so now move it to another language that people understand. Say it in English or bring it back to Hebrew. But it remains in Aramaic. Something of a mystery. Secondly, it's a very interesting flow, thematic flow, that goes through Halach Ma'anya. It has three sentences. They seem to have nothing at all to do with each other. You almost have the beginning, the middle, and the end of the Seder, like wrapped into one. We start by saying, this is the bread of affliction. Anyone hungry? Next year in Jerusalem. I mean, before you look around, it's like the Seder's finished. It hasn't even started. It's like a kaleidoscopic dissertation. Why do we go from thing to thing in that way? Is there any cohesion between these sentences? And finally, it's a little bit disturbing, but we need to raise the question, because I think everyone thinks about it anyway. The middle sentence, where we invite all those who are in need. It's very heartwarming. It's also completely useless. In other words, it is true that there is a great tradition of hospitality. The Jewish people do take care of those who don't have a place for a Seder. But the time and place to invite them is in Shul. I mean, that's where you'll see them. And indeed, Zachor Latov, many communities, they don't leave Shul until everyone has a place for Seder. It's wonderful. But that's the place to do it. Not when you've come home, close your door, made Kiddush, because there's nothing that makes a person feel more at home than having to catch up with everyone else who's already made Kiddush. And then all of a sudden, with great largesse, we say, Kol dichven yese v'yechol. I wonder in the history of Seder if anyone ever responded to and accepted that invitation stated at Halach Ma'anya. Practically speaking, the only person who could accept such an invitation would have to be someone who followed you home and is actually listening by the window. And I don't think that's the type of person that you really would want joining your Seder. So it's implausible for all of these ways. Also, in our current experience, he'd also have to speak Aramaic. So I think the odds are stacked against him, let's say that. So what's it all about? Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, the author of the Sefer Maaseh Hashem, one of the early Acharonim, and he devotes, the classic Sefer Maaseh Hashem, he devotes a lot of space to explaining the Haggadah. And he prefaces by saying, we need to know that the paragraph of Halach Ma'anya is not a natural part of the Haggadah, by which we mean, if you look in the Rambam says Halach Ma'anya was instituted for the exile. Halach Ma'anya is an exile paragraph. And what is its goal? Pesach brings with it a certain challenge. And in a sense, it's a challenge that we have on many such occasions. What's a good illustrative event is a wedding. A wedding is an apex of joy. And yet, as we know, the simcha is not complete. As long as the geula is not here, as long as the Jewish people have not been fully and finally redeemed, no simcha is complete. And that is represented by the breaking of the glass. Ironically, when the glass is broken, people erupt in saying Mazel Tov. Possibly, I'm not sure about the timing of that. A moment's contemplation should normally follow, and then one can get on with it with the Mazel Tovs. But either way, the breaking of the glass is not itself the cause for celebration. But in any case, we only wish joy for the Jewish people. but that's the concept. Im lo ale es Yerushalayim aro simchasi. As long as the final geula has not come, no simcha is complete. It's fair to say, fair description, that Halach Ma'anya is the breaking of the glass before the celebration of Seder night. Any Seder that takes place nowadays, and we're celebrating, and there is what to celebrate, chas v'chalila, do not mean to say, but there is what to celebrate. The fundamental connection that we attained and have maintained with HaKadosh Baruch Hu to become his people and all that we've enjoyed since then, sometimes better, sometimes worse in temporal terms, all of that is to be celebrated, no question about it. But the mistake that we don't want to make, which is easy to make, and you could be forgiven for making that mistake, is that once we start to celebrate, we imagine there's nothing else that we could want. And that is that's a dangerous mistake. Because once a person begins to feel that this is it, and we have everything that we could possibly wish to celebrate is right here, one loses sight of the fact that there's more, and one ceases to aspire to it. What hope does one have of attaining it? And then we're stuck. And therefore, it's a balance that we need on Seder night. There is what to celebrate, and we're going to spend the rest of the evening devoted to that. But first, we check in with Holach Ma'anya. We break the glass. And that's why we say, this is the bread of affliction. We have to realize that the Seder that we're having, in many respects, it's like the Seder that we had in Egypt. It's like the food that we had in Egypt. We're still in exile. You can't lose sight of that fact. The point of Pesach is not that the final redemption has come. The point of redemption is that the fundamental redemption happened, and therefore everything can emanate from there. But it hasn't yet. And therefore, as much as we're celebrating, we start by saying it is an impoverished meal that we're about to have. You have to recognize that so we can aspire to complete it. And what expresses this more than anything else? The centerpiece of the Seder, what a different experience it is in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, where the centerpiece is the Korban Pesach. Very, very different. One of the halachas of the Korban Pesach, interestingly, is that one can only partake of a Korban Pesach if you're registered on it from the day before. Before it was shechted on Erev Pesach, you have to know. That organized, you have to be. Most people can be organized half a day in advance. You have to know on Erev Pesach, before it's shechted, which korban you'll be eating from. And that makes Seder night, at the time of the Beis HaMikdash, very interesting. Because it emerges that in the time of the Mikdash, you could not join a person at nightfall for their Seder. You would have to have known already from earlier that day where you're going to be. And therefore, in a Yom Tov Dikur way, because the goal is not to plunge us into mourning, but we recognize that the Korban Pesach is missing. And how do we note that? We say, Kol Dichvin Yese V'Yechal. Anyone who wants can come and join us. The goal of this statement is not to issue an invitation. An honest invitation will be issued in Shul. The goal of this statement is to reflect and note how impoverished our Seder is. Anyone could come in. And if they did, we'd welcome them. Why? Because there's nothing to stop them. There's no Korban Pesach currently that they'd have to know in advance where they'll be. They could just walk in and join us. And that's a way of noting how impoverished the Seder is. And what is the goal? The goal is, as we said, if you note that the geula is missing, so then that stands you in good stead to greet it. If you lose sight of aspiring to anything higher than what you have, so what hope do you have of ever achieving it? And that's why we conclude by saying, Hashata Hocha, Lashana Baba Arad Yisrael, this year here, next year in Israel. What is the basis of that hope? The basis of that hope is the fact that we reflected that we are currently in Golus and the Seder is not complete. And in the merit of recognizing that, we say, maybe this year here, next year in Eretz Yisrael. Maybe this year, Avde Lashana Ba B'nei Chorin. And this brings us to a delicate point. Because the goal of Pesach is to celebrate the initiation of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not the culmination of our national destiny. There's many more elements to what it means to be the Jewish people. There are other Yomim Tovim. At Shavuos, we receive the Torah. Receiving the Torah is not the focus of Pesach. It's the focus of Shavuos. The focus of Sukkot is entering the land of Israel. That's what the Arba Minim is about. That's what we remember as Sukkot, remember the Midbar, coming into the land of Israel. Sukkot is dedicated to entering the land of Israel. It's a process, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot. And that puts us in a balance, because Pesach begins by remembering the land of Israel and ends by remembering the land of Israel. It ends L'shana haba b'Yushalayim. You can't lose sight of that as the ultimate goal. Having said that, the focus of Pesach is the initiation of the relationship. And this then becomes the emphasis of Seder night. And I would say further, we end by saying two things. Because there's two people that can lose sight of the end goal. People in Chutz La'aretz and people in Eretz Yisrael. People in Chutz La'aretz can lose sight of the end goal by feeling that this is where they live and they have no aspiration to ever live in the land of Israel. But people who live in the land of Israel can also lose sight of the end goal, because they might feel, well, here I am, and therefore I've achieved everything. I can't imagine that there's greater Jewish realization than my physical presence here in the land of Israel. And both of them are mistakes. I mean, happy is the one who's in Israel to make that mistake. He has less traveling to do. But they're both mistakes. Because until the time of the final redemption, so then to be in Chutz La'aretz is not the ultimate place where the Jewish people should be. But to be in the land of Israel without Geula is not the ultimate state that the Jewish people should be. Because without the Geula, they may be here, but they're not free. Not in the full sense of the word. As much as we aspire towards it, we recognize all too well that it's not true. Halavai that it was. If it was, the news, the daily news would sound very different. And therefore, we say two things at the end of Halach Ma'anya. And Libi Omer Li, that one is, of course we say them both, but one represents those who are in Chutz La'aretz and one in Eretz Yisrael. Those in Chutz La'aretz, they and on their behalf, we say this year here, but we aspire to next year to be the Eretz Yisrael. And those who are in the land of Israel, we say Hashata Avdi, L'shana ba b'nei Chori. Avadim can mean many things. It doesn't have to mean formal slavery. It can be having your hands tied. It can be being beholden to someone. It could be bound by certain policies, etc. and so forth. No need to elaborate. Again, turn on the news, and that's it accompanies us every day. And therefore, it's an amazing moment, the beginning of the Seder. There's so much to come, and yet we begin by recognizing what we don't have, but only because that's what we're aspiring to. The biggest mistake that we don't want to make is to feel that we've achieved everything, because at that point, when aspirations cease, attainments are doomed. And therefore, a Seder night, it's a night of celebration, but also a night of anticipation. And that's the blend that sets the tone for the Seder to come. This brings us to the end of our discussion this evening. Mitzvah Hashem will pick up again B'Sha'a Tova next Monday for our second session on the Seder and in Yom Pesach. Good night and a wonderful week.